Edie, if you want to field your questions, or I'll field them for you, whatever you want. How about Peter? You want to?
The kind of policy, the sanctions and the rest. I mean, it's an intriguing idea that he and other dictators might actually be responding to economic incentives. And I have thought about the problem, but I can't quite figure out what incentives they're responding to.
Well, I think his main aim to become the leader of the entire Arab world. He's an old-fashioned dictator in the style of some of the classical Middle Eastern or Near Eastern rulers. And he believes by defying the West, he will gain this big glorified position of becoming the Nebuchadnezzar or Harun al-Rashid of the Arab world. That's really what he's trying to do. And he's still young enough. He's about 60 years old. And the problems that have been inflicted on Iraq have not affected him. He is extremely wealthy. And the bombing that is being directed at Iraq has not hurt him in the least. So in a way, I'm not sure economic incentives will work. And he feels that time is on his side. Already, Clinton will be the third president to try to get rid of him and hasn't succeeded. So he feels maybe with a little bit more time, he will be able to achieve his goals. I think that's probably how he views the situation. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that's really his goal.
Mike Haggerty, University of California, Davis. Both you and Gidi have said that you're interested in changing the minds and hearts of people through this. And I think you have changed the minds and hearts of many decision makers, but not so much of the regular people in the U.S. And I've been tracking quality of life as perceived by people in the U.S. and in European nations. Actually, the National Opinion Research Center, of which you're a member, runs the general social survey, asked people questions for the last 25 years. Has your life been getting better, or has it been getting worse? 60% of people say it's been getting worse, which has surprised me. Similarly, tracking quality of life shows it hasn't improved much in the U.S., as judged by people's perceptions. It has improved in some European countries, like Denmark and Italy. And so my question, do you think the decision makers have moved so much to increase the incentives, which is valuable, at the top, but they aren't increasing the mobility at the bottom of our society? Would that be one, two questions. Number one, do you agree with that, whether people are being more satisfied? And number two, what do you think the reasons are?
Well, satisfaction is, and particularly how people answer questions about satisfaction is a difficult area. Reliability of a lot of this is a great uncertainty. There are many, by certain objective measures, people have certainly gotten much better off in the last 30 years. And by other measures, not so. Life expectancy, health, for example. If you look at people starting at age older ages, say 75, there's been an enormous and pretty linear increase in their life expectancy for the last 20 years. And they're generally healthier than they were in the past. Now, it's true, we have a dumb policy in the United States, as do all European countries, that while people are getting healthier at older ages and living longer, we're giving them more and more encouragements to leave the labor force through the way we structure Social Security. There's scarcely anybody in Europe who works over age 60 now. The United States is a little better than that. In Italy and Belgium, there's scarcely anybody who works over age 55. But that measure of quality of life is objective, and there's no question that it's improved substantially. Most dimensions of pollution are a lot better now than they were in the past, and that's significantly improved. Now, the one area, more than one area, there are other areas where the picture is less good. If you go back, let's say, to the 50s, crime is higher. The crime is a lot lower now than, as I mentioned, it was in 1980. It's much more livable in most major cities now than it was 20 years ago. And New York City's had a revival, largely based, in my judgment, on the significant decline in crime. But that's not, Giuliani takes credit for it, and he may have done, particularly relative to his predecessors as mayor of New York, a very good job in attacking crime. But the decline in crime may be greater in New York City is a national phenomenon. So that's a lot better. One area where things are maybe only modestly better, among the lower skilled individuals, less educated people, their earnings haven't risen. Real earnings haven't risen much in the last 20 years, although there's a problem with how we deflate money earnings by the price level of people. You're an economist, there's a difference of some controversy over it. But certainly what is true is their earnings have grown much more slowly than that of the more educated people. That's why it's how much more important it is to improve the quality of the schooling of people at lower levels. I think that's a way of making them feel that they have done better. If you look at welfare, well, welfare rose a lot in the 70s, it was flat in the 1980s, and it's fallen, and then rose a lot under the Bush administration until 1993, and has fallen a lot since 1993, partly because the economy has done better, and partly because the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 has had a significant impact, actually, on the number of people on welfare. So we have about 2.8 million families on welfare now. It peaked at over 4 million in the 90s and 93. So that's an area where we've gotten better. So I think overall things have gotten better. It could still be better. I think, there are many areas of educational policy where we could be doing better. We could have been attacking crime and still be attacking crime much better. And in some family areas, we could be doing better with divorce laws and marital contracts and so on, so some people are clearly worse off. But I'd be dubious of accepting any conclusions that the typical American is, by all the dimensions, not strictly monetary alone, but the overall dimensions, are worse off now than they were 30 years ago. I think they're generally better off, but there are some exceptions to that.
I have something to say on this topic as a former journalist. I think one of the things that's also has happened is that many people who today write for newspapers and the media are the generation of the 60s. I was a student then, I was active in some of these fields, and many of the people who are today doing this kind of work, they believe that the bigger the government, the better off are the poor, and therefore, anytime there's a movement towards any, let's say, relaxation of government control and greater market activity, they begin to sound the alarm bells. They interview people who are the worst, who have been hurt by this. And this really reinforces the fear that some people may have, oh, things are getting worse and not better. Because as Gary said, if you look at this 50-year period, things have improved enormously. Yet the general perception is that things are not really as good as they should be. And I think the press and the media, the television plays a very big role in this. And then they create mistrust of big business and all kinds of other things. This is why we have problems like Bill Gates' problem. Instead of being thankful to somebody like him, we're trying to destroy his company. So I think this has something to do with it too. Pardon?
The argument goes something like that the economic opportunity people who were
back in school in the 60s and had these liberal ideas are vastly increased, of course, if government is bigger. Because they're the kind of people who go and fill those jobs, and so they have a clear self-interest.
Of course, they're a big interest group.
In promoting policies which increase their economic opportunities.
Right.
So it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. But I think they do play a very important role because of their self-interest in creating alarm anytime things begin to change. Because it's amazing that they always find one family that's been hurt. You see it on every television channel. You see it on the first page of the New York Times.
Well, bad news is the grist, as you say, for the media. I mean, if you had only good news,
yes,
most of the newspapers would be out of business, I'm afraid.
That probably explains why people don't feel the improvement.
AJ, you wanted the mic? Mike?
The question I have is the even when good things happen and people observe the good things are happening, there seems to be a disconnect in the media as to the cause related to the effect, so that even when, for example, your crime goes down, there's very little discussion of the reasons for that. So people don't learn,
right,
and therefore seem willing to accept
right.
the...
Right.
Well,
the
not
other
only
view.
Poor little discussion is misunderstanding. In the column about it, 6 months or so ago, that's not in this collection, I had the headline from a New York Times article. This was a column on crime and saying why that the growth in number of prisoners has been an important factor in reducing crime. In the New York Times article that I referred to, the headline was, why is it that crime continues to go down even though the number of prisoners is up? Okay. And the notion that there's some connection between bringing more people in prison and deterring crime didn't occur to the journalist. So, you know, there are two separate issues, and Gidi and I sometimes differ on this. One, to what extent does somebody writing an article understand what's going on? And, you know, they may not be that's difficult. The other issue, to what extent is the press biased against markets and so on? And Gidi believes strongly the press is biased. There's no doubt that most people in journalism feel are liberal, not in the European sense of liberal, but in the American sense of liberal. But I've always felt, and that's where we may disagree a little, that a good journalist is more interested in getting the story right than in promoting particular ideas. Editorial staffs do that. Now, how true that is, that's where we differ. Competition helps us in that regard. It may not be a perfect solution. But I think often the issue is that the journalists are trained by the same people who train most of us, and the people training them don't understand the way these things operate. They don't believe that there is deterrence, and so the journalists don't believe it. It's not they're, you know, trying to foster something on us necessarily. Their teachers don't believe it, and the whole New York, you know, intellectual crowd in the traditionally hasn't believed it, and so it's my belief, maybe it's too generous, it's more frequently an indication of their lack of understanding than the fact that they have some ulterior motive. But the lack of understanding, and there we do agree, does transfer to the issue that most of them still accept the notion that big government is more often the solution rather than the problem. And they believe that. And so if they look at a problem as best they can, they'll see it as an indication, well, maybe the government isn't doing enough and it isn't doing the right thing, rather than understanding, which is often the case, we think, that if the government is doing too much. And so when, you know, they'll often lament if there's some kind of difficulty. I remember in the city of Chicago, there was a conflict between the mayor and the city council, so not much could get done. And they would lament, look at this inaction. Of course, we would all say, great, you know, fewer opportunity to do any damage. So I think it's more misunderstanding rather than somehow ulterior motives. But that's it. In either case, yeah, it may be both. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I was interested in your concept of accounting for domestic transactions in the national income accounts. I can't make intellectual sense of it, and I can't help thinking, if I go and microwave a bag of pizza for myself, a bag of popcorn for myself, all that happens is I get popcorn. But if my wife goes and microwaves a bag for me, the national income account goes up by a... Should we just microwave popcorn for each other rather than for ourselves, so to sort of pump up the economy?
Well, the old story used to be, when a man married his housekeeper, national income went down. Now his wife may go out into the labor force, so that isn't quite as good an example. But yeah, but the national income account, as we've said, is very imperfect, and many imperfections in them. And I think this, the whole omission of the household sector, I stress the role of women, because women have been so important and still are so important in the household sector despite their heavy labor force participation. The burden of women nowadays is they work a lot in the labor force and they do most of the work in the home as well. And that is a conflict that we haven't yet fully understood. But that's a major omission in national income accounts. And people have estimated, well, how much increase in national income will we get for the United States? The estimates, I think, in that column are from Robert Eisner, about 20%. There are various ways. There are two ways you can estimate this. One is you can sort of try to figure out what these people, let's say the women who are not working in the marketplace, would be earning if they went into the marketplace. And the other general way is to try to figure out what it would cost to buy that service instead of having it done in the household. They're not the same methods. They don't always give the same answer, but they give you a rough approximation about how you would want to go about doing it. And both of them suggest it's a very big factor. There's no reason why we couldn't begin to improve these accounts. In fact, there are several studies, like the book I mentioned by Robert Eisner and John Kendrick, by others, who show how they can get estimates of a much broader set of accounts. And now you might say, well, what's the role of doing that? Well, there are many different purposes of doing that. One is, I think, for women who want to spend their time raising their families or whatever, it gives them a greater feeling that they're making a significant contribution to national income, and that they can point to, look, I'm worth more than my husband in terms of what I'm doing. Another area is it gives us a better assessment of what's happening to not only levels of income, but changes in income over time, the growth rate. You know, we estimate the growth rate. Just a little analysis of that will easily show that we have lots of real biases in the estimate of the rate of growth of national income, and one of those is due to the what's going on in the household sector. And there are many other reasons why it's an important issue. So I think it's important. It could be done. There's no reason why it isn't being done, and it's just a tendency to stay with the set of accounts that we are experienced and have, and it would be much harder work to try to derive these new accounts. But we hope it'll eventually we'll move in that direction.
Capital piece and education. When you look at, I guess, the student population today, and you think that the educational levels are somewhat less than, you know, past generations, and then you look forward into time, and as the baby booms start to retire, there tends to be a gap of productivity. Could you elaborate on what that may mean for the United States in terms of future productivity and wealth creation generation?
Let me get a little clearer view, though, of exactly what you're saying. In terms of the levels of education or the quality of education?
Well, the quality and quantity of education of the people that are going to actually go into the workforce. Yeah. If you have to do so much remedial education of the coming, you know, the students coming behind us.
Absolutely.
There's going to be a gap because those people that are in the workforce now are going to retire. So the human capital element may wind up being less than what it is now. So what does that do to the marketplace in the future?
I think the U.S. does a good job in educating its population up to about 75% of the population. And this is sometimes misunderstood in international comparisons, because what they do is they compare people for the same years of schooling. And I have argued that the right way to do it, which is a productivity comparison, is to compare people who started students when they enter the labor force. And we have a very different educational structure in Europe. We sort of build up, you know, gradually. Our universities are generally harder than most universities in the rest of the world. Secondary schools are easier than most in Europe. I'm just saying that. Well, I'm saying across Asia as well. But we did it when people entered the labor force. We may still be look behind, but not nearly as much as we do if I measure people that are 14 years old. I think for the top 75% we're doing a good job. We're doing a very bad job at the bottom 25%. Now, consequences of that will be, of course, going to affect the productivity of the manager, it affects the productivity of the economy, the motivation of the people getting this education, whether the trade-off they make between going into selling drugs or going into other activities or other crime activities. The marital prospects, I mean, a whole host of economic, social, and political aspects. And therefore, I think a very high priority has to be to try to improve the education of this fraction of the population. And I mentioned vouchers before. Let me add one thing on vouchers. I suggest that we should have vouchers not simply for people who go to state secondary school. Those who don't like school and drop out have a voucher so they can get training at a company for a year or two after they drop out. Because we know that most, all of us, when we finish school, we're not really ready to work. So the industry does a lot of the investing in human capital. Unfortunately, the people dropping out of high school got a very poor high school education and don't have any easy access to any training programs. I would extend the voucher concept to go beyond school to training more generally to improve companies. And I think by doing that, we can begin not to fully cure that problem, but some of it through the families, not just through the school system, but a lot of it is due the things that are correctable, and this would be a way to tell you. Okay. Well, some people in the back.
Mathematical nature of economics. On the one hand, so many articles I see don't seem worth the reading by the time I get to the end of them and look at the massive assumptions that were thrown in there. And then on the other hand, there are many articles which seem to start with some preordained conclusion and just fool around with that hypothesis for 20 pages.
You want to handle that one?
No, that's your
Well, it's not the mathematics that's the problem, it's the economy doing mathematics. I mean that.
If you go back and you look at the non-mathematical literature when I was a graduate student, most of it was non-mathematical. There was a lot of confusion in that literature too, a lot of bad economics. Mathematics, appropriately used, can be a useful tool. Badly used, it'll be a source of confusion. And I would add two things to that only. There are scarcely any ideas that cannot be stated in words in economics and stated simply. And I think it should be incumbent upon everybody who writes an article, no matter how mathematical, to state the basic thrust of the analysis in words so that people can say, is this trivial, uninteresting, or is there something important that seems to be done here? And secondly, I think most people in the profession, you know, have to make their judgment about whether the person doing the mathematics is working on an interesting problem or is working on something, you know, completely uninteresting. So I agree with you. A lot of the mathematical work is terrible, completely uninteresting. But a lot of the non-mathematical work isn't any good. You know, so as somebody, well, I was sort of a joint major in mathematics and economics when I was at Princeton. I took a lot of mathematics. I'd be considered one of the less mathematical people nowadays, in my department certainly, but I was never afraid of mathematics because I had a lot of mathematical training and studied with people much better mathematicians than the people in economics are. They're not very good mathematicians, typically, and they shouldn't be. They're economists, and they're not mathematicians. So it never intimidated me. The problem is a lot of people don't have much mathematics, get intimidated by the mathematics. Which is unfortunate. Solution for that, I think, would be to require every article, as I said, to repeat, every article have a sort of non-mathematical summary. And then people will make their judgments and let competition reign. I think mathematics can be a useful tool. There are things you can state better mathematically than you can state another way. And we shouldn't, you know, it's just like saying, well, a physicist shouldn't use mathematics. We should be able to use mathematics. But that doesn't deny that a lot of it is junk and a lot of people don't have any good understanding of the economic problem. We have to, you know, there has to be a sifting of that. So it's not the mathematics per se, in my judgment, although it's often badly used.
I wonder why the writing of discriminant
among people on the basis of their income levels. When assigning vouchers, I was hoping in the previous comment you made regarding human capital, you'll take the opportunity to clarify your disagreement with Milton on this.
Well, I'll tell you why. I believe that people with the financial means should have to pay for the schooling themselves. They shouldn't get it from the government. An overall voucher system is a complicated system where you first tax people and then you give it back. I would say for people have the means to pay you themselves, why tax them in the first place? Require them to pay it. You may have public schools, let them charge tuition, like say universities do now. There's no contradiction between having public as well as private schools in which they charge tuition. And they would pay their tuition. It wouldn't be this complicated structure. We don't suggest there should be vouchers for people at higher education in the state system. At the lower income level, it's a question of trying to ensure that people come out of poor families should have an opportunity to get, let's say, to a high school education at state expense. That would be, that's where I would support the vouchers. At higher education levels, I think they should have to take out loans if they want to go on and repay them later. So I find an overall voucher system may be a good way to sell it politically, and it's what Milton argues. But in terms of where we want to go to, I think we want to go to a system where people of the middle class and the rich pay directly for their schooling, and we only support the people, the children, whose parents don't have the means to support them. That's why I would concentrate on that. Now, in fact, the poor education in the United States is at the lower end. So if you're saying, well, where is the real problem? See, I can give you other more complicated economic arguments. The middle classes, they move with their feet. They don't like a school system, and they can't afford even private school. They don't move to another community. You know, lots of communities compete. There's a very good economic analysis here on the competition among local governments. That's why a lot of us who are European type liberals prefer small governments and local governments rather than big governments. But you can move across the local governments. The poor, again, have that option much more consistent. Usually they start in the city or the rural area. They have an option. The rest of us don't have to. That's where the problem is. The solution is to concentrate on that as far as I can see and to try to get straight into the tuition funds that the other families have to make rather than trying to convolute the system of taxation.
No. Well, that's okay.
No, I wanted to say it.
Well, I just wanted to say that I'm very involved and I really support the voucher movement for the poor because I believe we have an urgent problem in this society to help We have 25% of children who are not getting the education they should get. And if we try to broaden it, I think it's going to take much longer. It becomes too complicated. Because of its urgent nature, I think we should try to address it right away and create the scholarship program. And it would be easier to carry out if it's a smaller group rather than just everybody. It would be, we won't have to overhaul the whole educational system. So I think practicality would mandate that be limited to probably the worst off at this stage. Maybe later we can make it change the system, but I think at this stage it should be the ones who really can't afford it. That's my opinion.
One more
question.
I don't know how to choose bid for it. That's where you got me. You pick, David.
I'd like to know what your thoughts are that now that the Dow hit 10K and what's going to happen at Y2K.
There's no action wise, that's one of the few good forecasts I had. I did write a column, and I'm not going to try to forecast, I'll be sued if I'm wrong. But I did write something, what was it, about a year or so ago, attacking Greenspan's statement about irrational exuberance. My statement was that I don't know whether the market's too high or not. Right? I know that Greenspan doesn't know either. and that when we were looking at the price-earnings ratios that we had at that time, I cited some data that there were many times in the past when we had those price-earnings ratios where the market continued up for quite a long period of time. So I think it's very dangerous to try to forecast, and we have to do it on our personal portfolios. I'm not getting out of stocks. I'm heavily invested in stocks, and Needy does her own investing to some extent, and she's heavily invested in stocks, and she claims her record is better than mine. I think she's right about that too, in fact. But you know, the price earnings ratios are very high values now. Now there's an article today in the Wall Street Journal by James Glassman, which claimed that the market will go to 36,000 rather than 10,000. I don't have that much confidence in his reasoning, that there should not be a risk premium on owning stocks rather than bonds, which is his argument. If you take away that risk premium, if you can increase the way we are now, that it'll go to 36,000. I wouldn't bet on it. I don't think that's right. On the other hand, whether the market correction has not been simply correcting an excessively high risk premium in light of current, by risk premium we mean the differential in the average return on holding equities and holding bonds. Over the long historical time, it's very well documented that you got about 5 or 6% percentage points more by holding stocks than holding bonds. That's well documented. The usual explanation we find is good for that is that that's the premium you get in just stocks for risk. In some sense, stocks are risk. Not against inflation, is what's happening with other risks. Another problem that there's for arguing markets. So, I think there's always going to be a risk premium. Whether it's going to be less than it was in the past, or the dual valuations, missing things. Very hard to know. I think the one thing we do know is that economists have been very poor at making predictions about future stock prices. On the other hand, we also know there have been bubbles in stock markets. The Japanese state is dealing with that. Stock market and property values and funds, swings, and so on. There are a lot of unexplained fluctuations. Don't fit in very neatly in a simple model of a fixed market and so on. That's the cost. Maybe we are on part of the bubble. On the other hand, the optimistic side is that most predictions in the past haven't been worked very much. And these families are no longer talking about it. That's what we're doing. And even Buffett is taking a more optimistic. So I think it's very hard to know. I mean, to watch the prudence of age in most of these things is one side of the other. Media financially is absolutely right. I have a portfolio with some balance, with often some protection, and some downward stress. That's
student today learn that I'm not going to jump to any position. I want to teach you how to talk about this conversation.
I want to thank our speakers tonight, Gary Becker and Judy Michelle Becker, for joining with us and educating us and getting some excitement as far as the potential of economics, and also for their book, which I hope everyone has gotten on. And if you haven't, there are copies upstairs, and I'm sure that for anyone who hasn't gotten one autographed, they'd be delighted to do so. In your packet also, I'll mention that there is a flyer on the next policy forum, which is on the 31st. This one, we shift gears a little bit. We're going to have two political theorists. Tibor McCann is also a fellow at Hoover part-time, and Jan Narveson from the University of Waterloo, and they're going to be debating theory of individual rights, whether it relates to so-called natural rights theory or utilitarian perspectives and other related things, and how that relates to many issues. So I want to thank everyone for joining with us and your questions, and look forward to seeing you again at a future policy forum.